Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Today we have a big one. This is one of the guests that I have dreamed about getting for a very, very long time. From the very beginning when I started this podcast, this guest is one of the ones that I dreamed of being able to talk to, and it finally happened. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. If you listen at the end, my good friend Jonathan Stormont, who is doing a little video work for us during the interview, gets on and asks a couple questions that he's going to use over on his column that he does over at the Jesus Creed blog for Scott McKnight. So listen for that at the end. And without further ado, here's a big one. So check it out. Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we are coming to you from the great state of Tennessee, and my guest today is Dr. N.T. Wright. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, are we still allowed to call you Bishop, even though you've retired from that post?
Yeah, I'm no longer doing the job, but it's one of those titles you do keep for life, like Reverend, you know, once you've been ordained, and likewise once you're a bishop. But I'm working as a professor now, so feel free to call me that if you prefer.
Well, my dad's a professor, and so I've called him Professor for a long time. I haven't got to call anyone Bishop before, so this is
okay.
A big honor.
That's fine.
Now, for much of my life, I have read your work and found a great deal of insight from it, and it's taught me a lot of great things. And so many times people ask me, Luke, what do you think about some subject? And my response is, let me go read what Dr. Wright has to say, and then I'll tell you what I think. But there's some subjects that aren't included in justification or talking about heaven that I was wondering if you could help me understand what I think about now.
Well, let's see if we can.
Okay, so, for example, do I like Chelsea or Man City? Who do I prefer?
Neither.
Neither. Okay, I'm good with that. William Wallace, Great Scott or Greatest Scott?
Probably not the Greatest Scott.
So we're just going to go...
That would be quite a hard one to call.
Okay, if we only had one author, we can take their full library, but it's the only author we get. Are we taking Lewis or Tolkien?
That is a very good question. I would have to take Lewis, that would be controversial. We'd have fights in my family about that because we have some real Tolkien fans as well.
They disagree with you?
We've never actually had that discussion, but I suspect that my oldest son, for instance, would probably be on the side of Tolkien.
Yeah. Would he really? What does your oldest son do?
He teaches history.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you have other academics besides your oldest son? You have... Four kids, right?
Four kids, yes. No, the oldest son is the only academic. They've all, you know, been through school, etc. But he's the only one that's kept up the academic profession.
Good. What do the others do?
A whole variety of things. My youngest son is a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And my two daughters have been in and out of various jobs. And the oldest one has just this week started a new job with a company in London where... it's a kind of very loosely a management consultancy, but that doesn't really describe the detail of it.
Do any of them have aspirations to be a writer like you are?
The oldest son is a professional historian, so he
of
writes.
Course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've written, some 60-plus books?
I think it's something like that, 60 or 70, like something. It depends how you count them, because some of them are reissues and some of them are collaborations and so on.
I would count them all. Just count them all. But how does someone write that many books? Do you just have like an encyclopedia of other books in your head that you could write at any given time that you just need to sit down and type out?
I wish it was that easy. No, there's always things that it would be fun to write about. And I've got other things that I'm supposed to be doing, like a couple of biblical commentaries, which I've been signed up to write for ages, one on Galatians and one on Philippians. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to doing those, but it's a matter of clearing other things off the desk first. And some projects write themselves very easily, whether things that I've been teaching for a while or been mulling over for a while, and then finally it all kind of comes into land quite quickly. Other things... they take a lot of wrestling and struggling, and so it just depends. But the little book that we have on the table in front of us, that was relatively easy, though there were lots of other ideas that were swirling around. And you know what the artists say, a sculptor will say, that they start with this block of marble or whatever it is, or stone, and the art is to take away all the things that aren't the thing which you can see in the middle. Yeah. And there's a certain amount of that with writing. It isn't just putting down everything on paper. It's stripping away the things which aren't, in fact, this particular
Perfect.
Construct.
Yeah. So if this is an easier book to write, what was one of the harder books for you to write?
The big book on Paul, which came out a year or so ago, was hard because of the sheer scope and scale. I mean, if you write a book that's... my publisher told me that it's got more words in the than the King James Bible, which I had not realised. but keeping that under structural control was... Well, the structure itself is okay, the macro structure, but there are so many different... small discussions within it that it's quite easy to get launched into it. I think, wait a minute, I actually talked about this 700 pages ago, and make sure I'm at least agreeing with myself, and maybe we then have to consolidate and have that discussion there rather than here, and then refer back to it. And so you have countless decisions of that sort. And just keeping tabs on what's going on right across the board was quite a challenge.
From the first word you put on paper to the very last word, how long did that book take you to write?
Which, the Paul book?
The Paul book, yeah.
Well, it wasn't a continuous process. I started the actual writing of that book in the fall of 2009 when I was on sabbatical at Princeton. And I think I wrote the final sentences in the spring of 2013. So, in between, I changed jobs, moved house, wrote three or four other smaller books. You know, I would keep coming back to it. And But it was the kind of project that was bound to take that sort of time, because once you get into it and feel its drama and its dynamism, then you have to allow it to shape itself as it goes along, something like that.
Yeah. If someone was to come up to you and say, what's your writing all about? What's the book that you give them? Like, what is the intro to N.T. Wright book that you give out? Is it simply Christian?
That's a good question. It depends entirely who it is and what background they're from. Yeah, in a way, simply Christian would be a good one, just as a sort of general starter kit. Somebody who knew a bit more about the history and was really up for a bit of the challenge and excitement of it all, maybe the New Testament and the people of God. When I wrote that book, one of the things I had in mind was, this was what I wish my students knew before they started to study theology, before they started to study the New Testament seriously. It was a kind of an introductory kit to what's going on. Because if you don't know that stuff, then you may be thinking you're going to write a paper about, say, the parables in Mark or what Paul thought about the law or whatever, but you won't get to first base if you don't know what the whole hinterland is of how the discipline works, what first century Judaism was like, etc., etc. So all of that's pretty important.
Yeah, very important stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so in your book, Simply Christian, you have four signposts, okay? Community, justice, beauty, spirituality.
Justice, relationships, I think I said, rather than community, yeah?
Okay,
yeah.
So...
Justice, relationships, spirituality, your relationships, beauty, yeah.
Okay, so those are the four.
Yeah.
Okay, was there like a number five that just didn't make the cut? Was there something that was like right on the precipice of getting in that...
There weren't at the time, but since then I've often reflected that if I was doing the same book again, I would have a fifth, which would be freedom.
Freedom.
Where you have the same dynamic. I mean, with each of those four, the fun thing about them is that... everybody knows they're good. Everybody wants something like that. And yet they're elusive. Everybody believes in justice from little children upwards. You don't have to teach a child about fairness and justice. Hey, that's not fair. You know, that comes with the kit of being human. And if somebody doesn't have that, we think they're psychopathic in some way. And yet we all know that whether it's in individuals or in societies, justice is actually very difficult to attain and to direct, and that we all secretly try and sneak round it in our own case. You know, if I've been driving too fast, I would really rather that the police didn't catch me, actually. That would be much nicer. And that's kind of a trivial example, but it's the same with relationships, it's the same with beauty. You know, we know that we are made for relationships, and yet both individually and internationally, we find it very difficult. Yeah. It's harder than we think it should be. And freedom would be the same, that we all know that freedom is a good thing, and yet does freedom mean just license to do what you like? You know, we're having this big debate at the moment because of the horrible things that happened in France last week. Does freedom of speech mean freedom to say absolutely anything at any time, no matter who is offended? Or are there limits to freedom? And if so, what are they? And so all these things are things that all human beings pretty much say yes to, and yet they're puzzling. Yeah. And they are all things which... The Bible and the Christian gospel affirm and yet say that actually the only way to get the proper form of these is through following the God we see in Jesus.
That's good. Have you thought about putting the freedom stuff down in a future work?
I've thought about it, yes. Uh-huh. But, tasks stack up like planes waiting to come into to land. Yeah. You have to do one thing at a time.
You could go back and talk about William Wallace. If you can talk about freedom, you could bring them all together, maybe?
Possibly. Curiously, I mean, I haven't actually thought much about William Wallace. I think people who study Scottish history and or watch movies or whatever would no doubt have him in focus. But even though I've lived in Scotland now for nearly 5 years, I haven't actually given very much brain space to William Wallace. Sorry about that.
Does watching Braveheart count as studying history?
Not really, no. Sorry.
No.
In fact, it would be a kind of a negative. You're sort of starting with a -5 if you start with that. Because, like all movies, it polarizes the story and falsifies in order to make its own particular dramatic point.
But he probably did paint his face and yell freedom really loud before battle. We're going to count that as true. Okay, so let's talk about something that's definitely true. This new book, Simply Good News, came out a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. Great book. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Now, you spend a lot of your time trying to make the argument that the message that, especially we do in the States, we do this a lot, is say, we've got a prayer for you to say, or whatever form it is that you have to get in. You say the prayer, you do the act, and then you're in. You don't go to hell when you die, you go to heaven. And you say, that's not gospel, that's good advice. We like that news. It seems like it's really fun. People like it. They'll sign up for it. They'll go to the front of church for it. What is so wrong with doing that?
Well, the thing that I'm saying in this book is that what you just described isn't news. It's advice. It's like saying, would you like to be sure that you'll be okay after you die? Mm-hmm. And of course, people, absolutely, yes, of course I'd like to be. And so the only element of news is that maybe people didn't realize that if you say this prayer or go to the front or whatever, then you'll be okay. But that's not actually... News is about something that's happened as a result of which everything is different. Mm-hmm. If I have a child who's seriously sick in hospital and we're not sure what the prognosis is going to be, and then we get the phone call, she's going to be all right. She's turned the corner. You know, then the news changes everything. She may still be in hospital. There may still be all sorts of tests and operations to be done, but basically we know we're going in the right direction. News is about something that has happened as a result of which something else will happen, as a result of which everything in between is different.
Yeah.
And the news changes you, as in that example. You can feel that your whole bearing, your whole sense of who you are, is changed by getting that news. And so the Christian gospel, the word gospel, means good news. And here's the other half of that, if you like. It isn't about how to go to heaven. One of the fascinating things about modern Western Christianity, and I've written about this in Surprise by Hope particularly, is that we are fixated on what happens to somebody after they die, and the New Testament has remarkably little to say about what happens to somebody immediately after they die. Has a lot to say about the ultimate destination of resurrection, and which goes, of course, with Jesus' resurrection. Jesus didn't, quote, die and go to heaven. He died and was raised, and what happened with Jesus is that heaven and earth came together, and that idea that something has brought heaven and earth together in Jesus, and that is the good news which can change who we are here and now. That's what it's all about, rather than this kind of insurance policy. Here's an insurance policy. You might like to, you know, I remember meeting a guy on a train once who tried to sell me a life insurance policy, and it was exactly the same kind of evangelistic thing. Do you want to make sure that your family will be all right once you're not around to provide for them? Uh-huh. We could really help you with that. And it's all advice, you know, with a cost.
With no good news.
Well, no, there was no, absolutely no good news at all.
Well, the good news is if you die, someone gets money.
But But that's a rather trivial sense of the word news.
Yeah.
News, some newspapers do in fact fill their pages with what are in effect magazine articles about general studies of something. But really, news is something that's just happened that we want to know about because as a result of what has just happened, things are going to be different. The horrible news from Paris last week has changed the discourse and debate about free speech, about Islam, about terrorism, about the nature of French society vis-a-vis American or British or whatever society. Something has happened as a result of which things are now different. That's what news is.
Yeah. So you say just happened, though. And in the book, you make the argument that in the first century, the issue for the Jews wasn't evidence. It was hope. Like, it was hope that, is this going to happen? And as you talk about something that just happened, it's been 2,000 years. And that seems like a long time for me. And so how something that's like 2,000 years old, it would be a very generous use of the word just to say, like, it just happened.
Well, in a sense, yes. If you think, as most scientists do, that the world is something like 14.5 billion years old, then actually 2,000 years is a tiny little blip.
But I'm only 33.
Okay. Yeah. So, but that's not, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, last year I took the funeral for an aunt of mine, my last surviving member of my father's family, and she was 101. And I was thinking, you know, if you think she lived a century, well, that's only 20 of those, and that gets us back to Jesus. That's not very many of those. And so that's one long lifetime. Okay, most people don't live that long or haven't lived that long, but that made me think this is really a very short time indeed. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the comparative sense of time is really rather trivial when we're talking about this sort of thing, because if you're having a really boring, tedious afternoon with somebody, it feels as though it's gone on for 10 hours and it may only be 40 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. But if you're having a really exciting time, then watching a movie that's really grabbed you.
Or a good podcast.
Oh, absolutely, a good podcast. Then 3 hours can pass in the blink of an eye. So I think that's what Second Peter means when it says one day with the Lord is like 1,000 years and vice versa. And I think our sense that it's a very modern Western sense, an impatient sense that if something's going to be important, we want to fix it this weekend.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, all that we know about God, all that we know about the world, is that God doesn't seem to work like that. Yeah. God doesn't seem to work on our impatient timescale. If you read the Old Testament, there's all sorts of things where, you know, Jeremiah says, okay, this is it, the city is going to fall to the Babylonians. And he waits for decades with the anxiety that he might turn out to be a false prophet. And then, of course, it does. And eventually he is proved right, even though it's very sad. And that's why in the Bible patience is such a virtue.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't need patience if, in fact, it was all just going to be over just like that.
Yeah, speaking of that, you have this line and you say the gospel that it's not about me. Is there any way we can change that and make it more about ourselves?
Oh.
Because that seems to be, like, that would do really well.
It depends what you mean by do really well. The only criterion for doing really well would be whether it ultimately is honoring to God and building up the kingdom. And,
okay.
And if by doing well we mean, yeah, people are going to like that. There's lots of warnings in the Bible about watch out for beware if everyone is speaking well of you. You know, that's not a good sign.
I try to skip over those.
Right there in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
But of course, in a sense, it's about me. But as soon as we swing the focus around and make it about me, then we turn the good news back into good advice, or it just becomes entirely the wrong sort of news. Of course, and some of the examples I give in the book, when we have the news, whether it's that a relative is recovering from an accident or an illness, or whether it's some major political thing that's happened as a result of which new possibilities for an entire country or continent are going to spring up, then in a sense it is about me. My life might be different. I might be able to get a better job. My family might actually be able to survive and not be hungry half the time, whatever it is. But it's about me because first and foremost it's about something that has happened which isn't about me, something which is much bigger than me, which then will affect me.
Yeah, that's good. But this isn't what everyone in the first century, in Jesus and Paul's time, they weren't expecting this. Some were expecting something, but as you say in the book, I mean, not everyone was expecting and knew exactly what was going to happen. And so as we think about this 2,000 years later, and we're thinking of the other end, like the double good news, we want the second part of the good news now. We're on that part. If in the first century they couldn't get the first part of the good news expected correctly, How can we get the second part of it expected correctly?
It's a very good question. And I think the predictions in the New Testament about the second coming and the new creation, the new heavens and new earth, are quite deliberately framed in this what we call apocalyptic language, which is a complicated system of myth and metaphor, which is describing something that's going to be actually true and real and factual, but we don't have good language for it at the moment. In Surprised by Hope, I talk about all our language about the future being like a set of signposts pointing into a fog. When I arrived here 2 days ago, the whole place was shrouded in freezing fog, and I was told it was a very beautiful place, and I had been here before, so I could guess, but actually looking out of my hotel room window, I could see maybe 10 yards, and that was it. But I believed what I'd been told, that in fact there was a beautiful place out there. And then, of course, when the fog lifts, well, it both was and wasn't like what I'd been expecting, but they were right. It is a beautiful place, but it didn't quite look like what I'd imagined that particular view would. But it seems to me this is, again, part of faith and part of hope and part of patience. Paul says, who hopes for what they see, but if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. And I go back in my mind to the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. They say, we had hoped that he, Jesus, was the one who would redeem Israel. And they had a clear picture of what redeeming Israel would look like. And it's one of the most ironic and beautiful moments in the whole of the story, because, of course, Luke's reader knows that Jesus has just redeemed Israel and the world. But they didn't expect this to happen by the Messiah dying on a cross. Now, then when Jesus starts to explain to them from the scriptures, foolish ones, don't you see this is how it had to be? Then they start to realize, and then, of course, they recognize him when he breaks the bread. And I've often had a sense that something like that is how it's going to be when the new creation happens. That for a moment we'll say, but this isn't what we thought it was going to be. You know, for instance, if you've been brought up to believe that at the end of the day you'll end up sitting on a cloud playing a harp, I think you'll be very surprised, because I don't think we will be sitting on clouds playing harps. Well, some people may have harps, who knows? But this is not, you know, the traditional Western pictures of heaven, in other words, just don't get anywhere near what I think is going to be the reality. So there will be big surprises, but then I think there will be the foolish ones moment. Don't you realize this is where the whole story was going all along? And I think there will be some big surprises, but I think we will then realize, oh my goodness, yes, of course, this makes sense of that whole narrative of Genesis through to Deuteronomy, that whole set of prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah, all that wonderful stuff in the Gospels. Of course, this was where it was going, but we still, even, you know, the most devout Christians couldn't see it. And that's part of the necessary epistemological humility, if you like, that we know enough to know that we can't know in detail what it's going to be like. That's why that's part of the deal. We are not supposed to be grasping onto the future as though that's the reality. We are grasping onto God, the God we know in Jesus, the God we know by the Spirit, and trusting him. And that's part of the trust, is that we trust him to do what is necessary to make his future come about.
Yeah. One of the things I've loved about your work is that it makes so much sense of the entire narrative of Scripture. It's covenant, it's creation, it starts with Abraham, it starts in the creation, in the beginning, it goes to Abraham, it goes to Jesus, and it's all one big narrative.
Exactly.
But there's pushback from a group of people that I think you refer to them as narrative breakers, possibly might be referred to as like the apocalyptic reading of Paul. And their pushback on you is that you read into Jesus, into what Paul's doing, and his understanding of Jesus is that this is the second Exodus. And that's where Jesus couches what he's doing, and that's how Paul understands. But the pushback from this group, which they're clearly wrong in my book, okay, clearly. But if I was to talk to one of these people asked, what would I explain to them if they asked me, well, then why doesn't Paul spell it out in as much detail as maybe we would like?
I think Paul does spell it out in quite a lot of detail, and I think actually Jesus does as well. And the trick is to soak yourself in the world of the first century, where many Jews in many different bits of Jewish tradition were retelling the scriptural story. One of the things that I had real fun doing in the Big Paul book was going right through that stuff in chapter 2 there, looking at the ways in which Jews were telling their own story. And again and again and again, they were telling the story in search of an ending, and the ending was going to be some kind of new Exodus, a real return from exile, the real return of Israel's God, all of those things. And they have various ways of talking about that, of describing it or of referring to it. And of course, in the Jewish festivals, the moment above all when they celebrate that is Passover. Mm-hmm. And we know, because Passover is still celebrated by Jews to this day, and we know how they celebrated Passover, we know what they thought, we know how they told the story, and it's not just looking back to something that happened when they came out of Egypt in whichever year it was, under Moses, it's about something that God is going to do again. And take a psalm like 77, where the whole thing is, what's gone wrong? Has God forgotten to be gracious? And the psalmist says, now let's get this clear. We'll go back and remind ourselves of what God did in the days of old. And they describe, the psalm describes, the Exodus. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly, this is not mere historical reminiscence. It's, we're in a mess at the moment, but God is the sort of God who does Exodus-like things. And the psalm ends with the implication, that's what we're trusting him to do again. So then, it all comes down to this. Jesus chose Passover as the moment to go to Jerusalem and do what had to be done. And he very explicitly, in his last meal with his disciples, did Passover-like things and told them to go on doing it, because this was how they would appropriate, as well as understand, what it was that was happening. You know, he didn't give them a theory, he gave them a meal. Yeah. And it's by that sense of being new Passover people that they're constituted. So then when we look through the New Testament, Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. When the time had fully come, God sent forth his Son to redeem, etc., etc. Paul, all of them, they're the book of Revelation particularly, it's a major Passover-oriented book. They're all picking up from Jesus' explicit and deliberate choice. It wasn't an accident that he did what he did at Passover time. That was his explicit choice to hook into that narrative. So that it seems to me the New Testament is absolutely full of signals that say, new Exodus, return from exile. Once we think into the first century Jewish world where that makes sense, the real problem, I think, comes within some strands of Protestantism, which have told the story of church history as a story of a big break. You know, we had the bad period, and then suddenly something radically new happened, and now everything is different. And so the idea of a continuous story is very scary, particularly because in the 19th century, some German philosophers thought in terms of a progressive revelation where God would gradually unfold things like a flower gradually opening out. And that's not the kind of thing I'm talking about at all. The story of Scripture is anything but a progressive revelation, as though Moses got a little bit, David got a bit more, the prophets got a bit more, and finally we got Jesus. Rather, it's a story of false starts, of people getting it wrong, of really bad things happening, of God hauling them back from the brink and saying, no, that's not the way. Of all sorts of things getting worse and worse, but nevertheless, when the new thing happens, when the redemption comes about, then it is clear that this is in fact what was promised all along. One of my research students in St. Andrews put it like this, that God acts shockingly and surprisingly and startlingly as he always said he would. Mm. In other words, it is the fulfillment, but it is still a shock. In other words, you can't attack this view by saying, oh, that's just that smooth line of progress. And I've never articulated that kind of thing. Some German theologians may have done in time past, but that's not what this narrative is about.
No. Well, the narrative obviously reaches the climax in Jesus, and the kingdom shows up. It's here. It's not fully yet here, but it's here. And so as we live in this tension of the kingdom, and we start talking about the message of the kingdom, the gospel is a pronouncement of the kingdom. A lot of people like that, especially people who have a desire for social change, political change. Mm. And you kind of have some pushback that maybe we're going too far with that. And so I'm interested in your understanding of the kingdom, especially when it comes to social and political change. Do you think that like social and political change that happens outside of, say, the church, just a kingdom activity, Or is kingdom activity relegated to just the church?
No, it's not relegated to just the church, but of course now, 2,000 years later, so much has changed which actually traces itself back to Christian impulses. It's one of the things that the last Pope, Benedict, used to go on about, that the values on which Western society has based itself have emerged from the long tradition of Christianity. And where we are now is in a rather dangerous time where people want to have some of those values, but without the Christian roots. And what Benedict would say is, actually, if you do that, you'll find that these values turn sour on you, and they will turn into just a list of special interest groups rather than anything coherent which is going anywhere. But if you look, for instance, at healthcare, at education, those two particularly, the church from the beginning has always done those things. And the fact that now, in most countries, most of the time, people know that there is an imperative to look after the sick, to look after the old, to look after the vulnerable, to look after the poor, and to educate people, not just the elite who can afford it, but basically the whole population. That was a Christian impulse from the beginning. And in the first century, it would have been unthinkable to say that medicine and education should be available for anyone who needed it. That in the pagan world, that just wasn't on the radar at all. But the church worked at all of that all the time. And the fact that we now have a social conscience about the plight of the poor, maybe not as much as we should, but in Western society broadly we do, that goes straight back to passages like Psalm 72. This is the messianic agenda, that the reason why the king will be given dominion over the world in Psalm 72 is because he cares for the poor and the widow and the orphan and the people who've got no one to help them. It's very explicit. And so when we see Jesus doing what he's doing, we see the launching in real space-time history of the project which the Old Testament had dreamed of. And what we see now in today's world is all sorts of bits of society, many of them not giving any explicit allegiance to Jesus, but nevertheless saying, we've got to do that stuff. And that's where the church should stand up and say, yeah, and you know where that idea came from in the first place, and we're right behind you, we're with you on that. You know, Jesus said, both the one that is not with us is against us, and the one who's not against us is with us. And part of the wisdom of Christian engagement with the world is knowing, discerning when the one applies and when the other applies.
Yeah. But the kingdom still can advance even if it's not under the umbrella of the church.
Absolutely. God can do all sorts of things in God's way. However, the church has to retain, as it were, the right and the responsibility to speak the truth to power, to warn that a particular agenda has taken a wrong turn. That if somebody says, well, we believe in freedom, and that's what the Christian gospel is all about, isn't it, freedom? And then they say, therefore, we are free to do this and this and this. The church may have to say, well, those first two may be, but the third and the fourth, actually no, and here's why. And so there has to be a constant dialogue. And this is why I go back again and again to John 16, where Jesus says that very strange saying about when the Spirit comes, he'll convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. It's a complicated passage. But how will the Spirit do what the Spirit's going to do? And the answer is, the Spirit is poured out on the church so that the church can hold up the mirror of what God is wanting to the world around, even though it may be dangerous to do, and say, no, you're going the wrong way. But also, of course, to be right there with, celebrating with, anything that's going the right way. Mm-hmm. Paul says, whatever is true and lovely and honourable and of good report, that's great. Think about these things. And he says in Romans 12, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. In other words, don't be mealy-mouthed and say, no, we'll only sympathise with you if you come and say a prayer or be an explicit Christian. No, human life is God's gift. It's rich and full and wonderful. And the kingdom of God is about that human flourishing. The church should celebrate that while remembering that actually ultimate human flourishing does only come through the utter transformation which is effected by the gospel.
Oh, that's good. So what the Spirit is working against is what? Now, there's a lot of people that have loved your kingdom stuff that have in some ways kind of pulled you into the anti-empire crowd as the empire being the enemy. If I read your book correctly, it seems like you're saying that the Satan, the devil, the accuser is the enemy, not the empire, which is good because I live in one of the most powerful, the most impressive, the most dominant empires ever, the state of Texas. And so I don't want the empire to be the evil one. I want it to be the devil. Is that right?
Yes and no. Yes and no. It's very interesting. In the Gospels, we see continually Jesus redefining who the enemy is, because in his day it was all too easy to identify the enemy as oppressive pagan forces, and there was a long tradition going back to Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Egypt, Syria. You know, the Jews had these long memories of all these empires that had oppressed them, and now it was Rome. Mm-hmm. So it was easy to see those empires as satanic. But here's the trick. That way you can easily fall into a dualism where you think that all political power is by definition bad. And, of course, the great freedom movements of the 18th century and 19th century did often tend to think that way. Only then they discovered that they had to set up political powers of their own, and then it became a really rather odd business. All other powers are bad, but of course we're good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then one says, post-modernity says, sorry, you've just tripped over your own toe, as it were. But here's the thing. If you're a creational monotheist, and the Bible is basically about a good God making a good world and wanting it to be run in his way, and if you believe in the image of God in humankind, then that image is that partly that God wants to rule the world through obedient, wise humans. And God calls humans to that task, whether or not they know him. It's very clear in the Old Testament that God calls pagan rulers, and sometimes it says quite explicitly, you don't know me, but I'm calling you, I'm giving you a job to do, and you're going to do it. This is Cyrus in Isaiah 45 and others as well, and think of the kings who are called to account in the book of Daniel and so on. One of the most amazing statements of this is in John's Gospel when Pilate says to Jesus, don't you realize I have the authority to have you killed or to release you? And Jesus doesn't say, oh, your empire's a waste of space, it's pagan, it's nasty. He says, you couldn't have any authority over me unless it had been given you from above. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you has the greater sin. In other words, Jesus is affirming the God-givenness of Caesar's empire. Now, when we hear that, we tend in our world, because we live on a left-right spectrum where it's all one or all the other, mm-hmm. we tend to say, oh, so there it is. The powers that be are ordained by God, so they're fine. And Jesus says, no, therefore, if God has given you that responsibility, if that is being abused, that is a major sin. The one who handed me over to you has the greater sin. In other words, just because God has given you this task doesn't mean it's working out well. It can be radically corrupted by evil. And this is something which we find very difficult in the post-Enlightenment Western political thought to grapple with. One of the difficulties we face here, to be honest, is that there was a long tradition of Christian political thought from the very beginning, from Paul onwards, right through to the 18th century. But the Enlightenment, which happens to be when your country and France came to their present constitutions, the Enlightenment basically said Christianity is not about politics. It's about going to heaven. It's about saying your prayers, etc. And we will run the world our way. And so the church has often colluded with the idea that there is no such thing as Christian political thought. And then it becomes simply a matter of, okay, does the gospel make us left-wingers or right-wingers? Yeah. Do we believe in great powers or in radical freedom for all? And the answer is it's much more interesting than that, much more complicated than that. God wants the world to be wisely run, but God will hold rulers to account. You know, in the ancient world, they voted in magistrates into office, but the key thing was when the magistrates or the rulers had finished in the office, they held them to account. They often put them on trial and sometimes banished them for their mismanagement. In the modern world, we assume that once somebody has been elected to office, then they can do whatever they want to do because they have a democratic mandate. The ancient world is much more savvy than that. They would say, no, we want to look at what you do and hold you responsible for it afterwards.
Are you saying cable news networks don't count for that?
News networks actually do some good in that respect. But then what's happened there, this is a very interesting phenomenon, that the news networks, newspapers and broadcasters, have in the Western world taken over the role of the church, where the role of the church was to speak the truth to power, and the newspapers and the broadcasters have said, no, we'll do that now, thank you very much. We will hold the government to account.
When you were talking with your friend Stephen Colbert a couple years ago, did you empower him to have this function, this role, tell him this is what he's doing for the kingdom of heaven?
I don't think we quite had that conversation. It was a fascinating time. You know, they say you should never act with children or animals. You know who the other figure on the Colbert Report that day was? Cookie Monster.
Oh, goodness.
I shared the Colbert Report that day. So I think mine was sort of lost in a blaze of the cookie nonsense.
Well, definitely a career highlight to share the stage with the Cookie Monster.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so let's go back to like new creation, resurrection. We believe in new creation. We believe in resurrection. There actually was a guy last night at your presentation you did, who I saw in the parking lot. His vehicle, it might have been a lady, I don't know, but his vehicle had a sign that said, "Not of this world," like a sticker there, which is kind of ironic because he might have been out there afterwards with a razor blade scraping off going, "Maybe I am of this world." So how do we move past that sort of literal, you know, view of kind of like the world that we get with the rapture community, and really embody new creation without kind of falling into that temptation?
Yeah. I mean, that phrase particularly, again, it's from the Johannine Passion narratives when Jesus says, "My kingdom is not from this world." And in the King James Version, it says, "not of this world." And people have used that phrase as a way of importing a kind of a Platonic distinction. And so there's some pretty radical teaching which has to go on there. But in part, you know, it is all about the resurrection, that if people really take seriously the fact that Jesus was alive again 3 days after his death with a body that was clearly transformed, it wasn't just resuscitated, but was different so that it was now not susceptible to death and was equally at home on earth and in heaven, then once we start reflecting about that's what God is going to do for the whole creation. In Romans 8, that great central passage to which so much of Scripture points, Romans 8 says basically that God will do for the whole creation in the end what he did for Jesus at Easter, and he'll do it for us in the middle of it. And that is the most spectacular promise. So it invites us to probe and say, what exactly was Easter all about? And how did they recognize the risen Jesus? And what did he commission them to do? And it's out of that, not just, okay, he's back again and he's given us some orders, but something is going on there to do with the very nature of creation itself. So that if new creation has been launched with the resurrection of Jesus and will be completed when God does for the whole cosmos what he did for Jesus, then we, by the Spirit, are living in between the one and the other, and our task is to bring to birth signs of the kingdom, things which really are part of new creation. That's why the sacramental life is so important, and it's why, if you have the wrong cosmology, the sacraments are very difficult to understand, because they always collapse into either magic or mere memory. And in fact, the sacraments are designed to be hints and signs of real new creation in advance. But then you discover, and actually the Eastern Orthodox tradition has known this all along, and we in the West are having to scramble to get back into it, you discover that there's all sorts of things. Jesus' instance is giving a cup of cold water to somebody because they're a disciple. And that becomes part of the kingdom. It becomes part of the new creation. And new creation is always breaking out. It's always on the edge. Had an amazing example from a friend who's in parish ministry of a family decimated by a murder within the family, and the way in which the gospel is beginning to turn that around, so that you can actually see this family now in church with tears in their eyes, just with new creation happening to them after one of the most terrible things that could have happened. And it happens small scale, it happens large scale. The fact that there are people in prisons in my country who do the Alpha Course and who come to a very real and vibrant faith. The Alpha Course is in one third of the prisons in the UK now, which is wow. You know, extraordinary. People's lives are being transformed, and this stuff is real. And when that happens, it's not just individuals, it happens to structures. People say, we're going about this in the wrong way. We need to change the system. We need to change the way we do this. And these are always partial. It isn't that we are building the kingdom of God by our own efforts. But if we imagine that there's nothing we can do till Jesus returns, then we will end up like the man who hid his master's money in the ground.
Mm, that's good. But it all hinges on resurrection.
Like, absolutely.
That's the centerpiece of it.
Absolutely.
Now, you make an interesting statement in the book. You talk about how you and others in your profession have studied, have researched, and you can say that there... I'm just going to read this quote so I don't mess it up. Within the first century, we have come to the conclusion that these stories are basically trustworthy. The demand for proof often comes from people who have scientific proof in mind, but that's not how the kingdom works. You say these things: Jesus' life, his announcement of the kingdom, his radical redefinition of that kingdom, and his death on the cross. We can be certain of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Certain. Like, they're like, I don't need to have any concern. Like, that might have been exaggerated, that any of those things are not true.
All those things you just listed, and it does sound like a quote from something I would have written, so that's fine. But all those things you just listed, I think we can be certain of them. In the same way that we can be certain that Julius Caesar was murdered by a set of conspirators, in the same way that we can be certain that Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, mm-hmm. Those things you've listed, we can be certain of. Now, of course, when you go to some of the details, you say, well, according to Mark, when the rooster crowed, when Peter was denied, Jesus
off, yeah.
went like this, and with Luke it was like that, and John was like... and it's quite difficult sometimes to fit all that together. But really, that is trivial. Really, that doesn't yeah. matter. What matters is that Jesus was who he was, that he announced and inaugurated the kingdom, and he died on a cross believing that this was the new Passover moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, but your list does not include miracles or resurrection. Now, you did write this, I promise. I copied
and pasted
out of your book.
No, sorry.
But, okay, but you didn't include miracles or resurrection.
Because I wanted to be able to say that actually anyone, anywhere, should be able to say, okay, I can see Jesus did those things we've just listed. But then the point about miracles, and I don't actually like the word miracles, because the word miracles in the post-Enlightenment world implies that the old creation is all that there is, and then God sort of steps in and does something bizarre just to show that he's God or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm with C.S. Lewis on this one, that the healing miracles and the multiplication of loaves and so on, anticipations of the resurrection, because what's going on there is that this is new creation bursting in. Mm-hmm. These things would be bizarre if all there was old creation. But when you suddenly say, wait a minute, the Old Testament is full of prophecies and predictions about God renewing the world, what would it look like if he did that? And you realize these are not odd or bizarre. They are the utterly characteristic things that happen within new creation. The problem is that new creation and old creation are uncomfortably overlapping right now,
yeah.
and that Jesus is embodying the new even while the old is screaming blue murder and doesn't want to know and ends up killing him. But, of course, you can't expect somebody out on the street who's never figured any of this out just to say, okay, so Jesus did miracles, not a big deal, because it is a big deal.
Yeah.
And the only way that that can become sensible and wise and good to believe is if you realize the truth of the resurrection. And so it all does hinge back on the resurrection. And the danger there is if you try to prove the resurrection within the terms of the old world. The resurrection is not a bizarre event within the old world. It's the defining event which launches the new world.
So I don't need to have any doubt that it happened. I can... I don't need to ever worry, well, maybe this is exaggerated, maybe just like some other people...
So maybe which is exaggerated?
The resurrection.
Oh, the resurrection. No, there is... I mean, doubt is what happens when you look hard and say, can it really be true that the new world would break in upon the old world? And the answer is, no, that's a very bizarre and odd thing to say, so why should I believe it? And then we look at the New Testament and we find that it isn't something you can put into a test tube. It isn't something that you can say A plus B plus C, therefore, if you don't believe this, you're stupid. You know, there are some apologists who try to make that kind of argument, a sort of a logical argument which forces people to believe. And it really isn't like that. What you can do with historical argument is demonstrate that the normal skeptical or atheistical answers really aren't nearly as good as they're cracked up to be, and that actually it's a choice. Do you believe, is it possible that there is a God who not only made the world but loves the world and wants to renew the world, and that this God came in person in and through Jesus to do precisely that? And when you then look at what happens as a result, all the way in which the early church develops and why they do the things they do and how they do the things they do, then I look back and I say, the only way I can explain what happened is if that really did occur, that it wasn't a dream. But that's, you see, the danger if you say, okay, we can be absolutely certain about that, people hear that back within the old world of a kind of a rational, almost skeptical way of going about things, and it reduces it to that. And here's what I was talking about in my lecture last night. We are not to be conformed to the present age, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And so there is a renewing of the mind. Now, can I just say, there's a real danger in this, which I didn't go into in my lecture, and that is that Christians imagine that the transformed mind exists in a totally different space to the old world, so that we just have our truth, which we believe, and of course the people out there don't believe it because their minds aren't transformed. But the point is, and this is why the New Testament is so exciting, that the new world breaks in upon the old world and is meshing with it and infecting it and transforming it, and so that it isn't a safe space where the Christians just hold their truths and that's fine, and everyone out there is in darkness. It's a contested truth, and it has to be won and articulated and lived again and again and again. So it's a new world which has broken in, but for us too, the new world breaks in upon us as we struggle with the fact that we are still living within the old.
So in the first century, their issue is hope. In the 21st century...
The Jewish issue is hope.
Yeah, the Jewish issue. The Jewish issue. It seems like in the 21st century, at least... Okay, and I'm just saying for people, and by people I mean myself, the issue isn't hope. It's evidence. Like, many people have hope. Okay, I'm going to go to heaven when I die. God's going to make the world right. I'm good with that. But the issue is, what happens right now? Can I really believe that? Like, do I have enough evidence for it?
I think there are quite a few people who do approach it like that. But actually, I think to say evidence or not is a very modernist way of going about things. And within the broadly postmodern world, which is where most of our world is, whether it realizes it or not, I mean, in the media and magazines, etc., it's more, does it feel good? Can I sense it? Are the vibes good with this? Because people will go with where, literally or metaphorically, where the music is taking them. Mm-hmm. And then they will look back and say, was I fooling myself, perhaps? So it isn't just a matter of evidence. Evidence implies that it's a sort of reductive thing. It's almost reducing it to a formula, to a chemical formula or to numbers. It's much, much, much bigger than that. And that's why in Simply Christian I talk about justice and relationships and spirituality and beauty, and I would toss in freedom as well, that actually all these things start to resonate in a new way. And if somebody says, have you got evidence for that? Well, how do you have evidence for something that suddenly makes sense in terms of beauty or spirituality? And yet these things are enormously important, much more important for most of us most of the time than mathematical formulae, actually. Yeah. And so my point would be that when you believe in Jesus' resurrection and that God is going to do that for creation as well, suddenly all those areas come into new focus, and we realize that there is a different sort of fulfillment to justice and relationships and beauty and all the rest of them, which we'd not imagined before. And that carries its own conviction, not because of evidence that we can add up, A plus B equals C, but because of a much larger whole which makes sense of the entire worldview.
That's good. That's good. Okay, one last question, then we'll get you out of here. In your book, you describe God this way. You say, God is an untidy God. Now, I've always heard that cleanliness is next to godliness. So how can God be next to cleanliness and also be untidy at the same time?
I merely observe the world that God made. It seems to me that a God who can make, gooseberries and giraffes and whales and waterfalls and so on, This is a God who just loves literally splashing stuff around and saying, hey, get a load of this.
Yeah. You know,
my wife just sent me a photograph of storm at sea just a mile from where we live at home. And this huge wave crashing in by a lighthouse. And You just think, yeah, the sheer power of this. And of course, if we had made a world, somebody would have said, no, there are health and safety issues here. We can't have waves like that. Yeah. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. We can't have tectonic plates that grind against one another. But something about creation, which is mysterious and dangerous and powerful, seems to be the sort of world that God has made. Now, that raises all kinds of other problems, of course. But rather than back off from those problems, I think we have to say, no, God is exuberant. When God made the world, when he said it was very good, he didn't mean it was all lined up in neat rows, 17 rows of this and 25 rows of that, and we can all tick them off. It's much wilder than that. And that's why the human task of reflecting God's image into the world and summing up the praises of creation to God, the human task is not to flatten down God's world, but to enable it to flourish and to find human flourishing in doing just that. Mm. And that regularly is much more untidy than we might like.
Mm. Well, this has been an absolute honor for me to get to spend this time with you. Your books
have
been a huge blessing to
me.
Well,
it's an honor to me that you've taken the time to think into my work.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.
One of the things that I hang out with a lot of pastors, we love your eschatology. We love this vision of a new heaven and a new earth and the giving us the tools to dismantle the Gnostic kind of bits that we have. Mm-hmm. What does that look like for somebody who, you know, serves the local church, sits in budget meetings, and what does it look like to have that kind of hope on a local church level?
Yeah, that's a huge question. And obviously, for many years of my life, I was doing precisely that when I was in pastoral ministry and when I was working as a bishop. And I think what the hope does for you is that without that, you would look at whether it's the budget decisions or whether it's the church needs a new roof or whatever it's going to be, and you might have this awful sense of, oh dear, are we ever going to get there? Is it worth it? Are we actually whistling in the wind? And the answer is no. God has already done new creation. That's the news of the gospel in Jesus. God will complete that at the end. And what we do now, if it's done prayerfully and with waiting on God and with the guidance of the Spirit, what we do now is part of that. That doesn't mean that our little human projects will all be successful in the world's terms. It means that we are planting seeds which will grow and bear fruit. And here, when I was working as a bishop and having exactly those sorts of conversations, we came back to the parable of the sower and to the other parables in Mark 4 and Matthew 13 and so on, again and again and again, to encourage our clergy with whom we are working and the laity as well with whom we are working, that what you do in the Lord is not in vain, as Paul says at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, that you are planting seeds, and you may not see in your own lifetime what the fruit of those seeds will be, and it is possible that some of the birds of the air will come and gobble some of them up. But if you are planting faithfully and wisely, then there will be good seed, and it will land in good soil, and it will bring forth fruit 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. So the hope is precisely the hope of the parable of the sower. Obviously, and this is part of the reason I think Jesus was telling the parable, there are puzzles along the way as well, but the point is we shouldn't be put off by the puzzles, by the apparent, in human terms, failures, but we should look to the eventual fruit which God will bring.
You, in your recent book, you talk about, there's a couple of sections where you talk about progress, and you talk about the way that we kind of mesh progress and kingdom of God talk often.
Yeah.
And then you have some things that made me think. You talk about entering the kingdom, receiving the kingdom. That is the way the Bible talks about it.
Yeah.
People that, a lot of my pastor friends, including myself, we talk about advancing the kingdom, building the kingdom, and then we get kind of angry.
Yeah, that's why in Surprise by Hope, I rather carefully talk about building for the kingdom rather than building the kingdom. And the image that I use, and I've used it again and again, is of the medieval stonemasons who were building a cathedral. And the individual masons, if you said, what are you doing? And they said, I'm building a cathedral, that would be grandiose and ridiculous, because the master builder is building the cathedral. What you're doing is carving this bit of stone, and it'll take you several weeks to get the carving right and the pattern right. And then one day when all the stones are gathered up, you will see your little bit of stone up there on the west front or the east wing or whatever it is, and you realize that you were building for the cathedral. You weren't actually building the cathedral. That's what it'll be like, it seems to me, when God completes God's new creation, that the things which we've done, the things which loom so large for us now, will be these tiny little bits and pieces, and we realize they are part of a much larger pattern than we could ever have imagined. And that is part of the humility of it, that the things that we think are so important, maybe a tiny little twiddle, a gargoyle here or a water spout there or whatever, on the great design that God has, and some of the more substantial, solid things in the middle of God's new creation will probably be things which we didn't even notice were happening, but which faithful, humble, quote-unquote, ordinary Christians were getting on and doing below the radar when nobody was looking. Mm. Those will be the things that will really be making it. That's back to the Beatitudes again. It's not the big, loud-mouthed, bullying people who are mentioned in the Beatitudes. It's the meek and the humble and the hungry for justice people and the mourners and so on. They're the ones who make the kingdom happen. So it's building for the kingdom rather than building the kingdom in our own way.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brother Tom.